You're listening to Arrivé by The Cycling Podcast. This episode is made possible by Bicycle, the leading global marketplace for pre-owned bikes.
Hello, good afternoon, welcome. Welcome, young Richard Abraham, for the last Arrivé of our spring season. Last men's Arrivé, I should say. It's a bit of a race with Rose et al. See who gets their episode out first. But a spring season that has seen, well, many exhibitions, much excellence, not much suspense. However, as anyone who watched today's Liège-Bastogne-Liège will know. But Richard, how the devil are you?
I'm not too bad, thanks, Daniel. Yeah, I'm doing all right.
A good edition of Liège. How many stars do you think L'Equipe will give it tomorrow out of five?
I don't know. I don't want to be too harsh to Liège as a race because it doesn't often generate a five out of five, does it? It doesn't quite have the instant sort of grabbable suspense or drama of something like Roubaix or Flanders. But it,
what, we saw so much suspense and drama in Roubaix and Flanders this year.
That's a very good point, yeah.
I feel that it's got its mojo back the last 3 or 4 years since they changed the finish, since they moved away from Anse.
I don't think moving away from Anse could do anything other than improve Liège. I remember that old finish was, certainly not the most scenic or picturesque, was it?
No, it wasn't the most scenic or picturesque, and the great problem with it, and maybe we've been spared in this respect this year, was that it left Liège and the whole sort of triptych of the Ardennes, if you want to call them that, open to the same scenario, i.e. the strongest puncher that particular week winning all three races, which happened a couple of times. It happened with Davide Rebellin in 2004. It happened with Philippe Gilbert. What year was that? 2011 or 12? It nearly came to pass on several occasions, did not. But since the finish of Liège has changed, then we've seen more kind of, well, the race open to more permutations, I would say. Although the strongest rider usually does win this brutal race, because it is a brutal race, over 4,000 meters of climbing, 250 kilometers, and particularly those last 100 kilometers of Liège are a match for anything on the calendar in terms of altitude gain and lack of respite, lack of time for the riders to recover. But Richard, a lot of waffle from me there, pre race roundup. Should we get on with that, shall we, and tell people, anyone who didn't know and wants to have their highlights viewing spoiled, let's tell them what happened, shall we? It was the 110th running of Liège-Bastogne-Liège, the oldest monument on the calendar, of course. So Richard, a lot of talk about the weather this week, largely because we, of course, had that Arctic edition. I called it the Arctic Race of Belgium, that Arctic edition of Flèche Wallonne earlier in the week. It was cold at the start, pretty cold, and not quite sort of Eskimo weather, around 3 degrees. There was a bit of wind as well, 15 kilometer per hour. What looked like was going to be a tailwind towards Bastogne for the first half of the race, and then a headwind back towards Liège. On the starting grid, of course, we had Tadej Pogacar after two sort of ill-starred years as far as Liège-Bastogne-Liège was concerned. Last year, of course, he did start the race, but had to pull out with a broken wrist, which subsequently hampered his Tour de France preparation. 2 years ago, he pulled out at the last minute, didn't start the race because of a bereavement. Mathieu van der Poel, after his outstanding spring, he was back trying to win Liège. He was the first man to win Flanders and Liège in the rainbow jersey in the same year. Again, it would be handy to have someone who'd written a biography of Eddie Merckx on the podcast. Stephen Williams was also among the favourites, having won Flèche Wallonne on Wednesday. Tom Pidcock, the winner of Amstel Gold, he also had high hopes. He was starting in an Ineos Grenadiers team, which also fielded Egan Bernal. Ben Healy, who had his breakthrough in the Ardennes last year, he was riding for EF Education first easy post with Richard Carapaz, who we didn't really mention much on Wednesday, but was clearly in good form. Benoît Cosnefroy, winner of the Flèche Brabançon a couple of weeks ago, which really kicked off the Ardennes swing. Then we had some other significant names, some of whom had been in action at the Tour of the Alps in midweek. Romain Bardet, David Gaudu, he wasn't at the Tour of the Alps. Romain Grégoire, Maxime Van Hills, Simon Yates, Alexey Lutsenko, Kevin Vauclin, second, of course, he was in Flèche Wallonne. Michael Matthews was also starting, a race that he's had some success in the past. And Mark Hirschi, of course, for UAE Team Emirates, maybe a plan B for them. The race summary, Richard. Nine-man group got away in the first hour of racing. I'll just give their surnames. Vliegen, Calmejean, Rochard, Scaroni, Dubé, Ursulin, Helders, Romeo, Lainza. That was the nine, I believe. Their maximum gap was just over 3 minutes, and they were still down the road. When 97 kilometres to go, the peloton came into the little hamlet of Alavoie de Sainte-Vite. And there, a rider slipped out on the right-hand side of the road. We're not entirely sure who it was. I think it was an Arkea rider. It was certainly a very narrow stretch of road. And, well, there was a big pile-up. And Mathieu van der Poel, conspicuously, was caught behind the pile-up. And in very short order, very quickly, he found himself about a minute behind the peloton containing Pogacar. He wasn't the only big name to be caught behind that split. Peo Bilbao, Simon Yates, Mauri van Sevenen, Alexander Vlasov, Grégoire, Attila Valter, Pidcock as well, Valentin Madouas. They were all in there. Alpecin de Koenig, particularly Luca Vergalito, was pulling to try to get them back on terms. But with that gap stretching to over a minute, it did look as though Pidcock and Van der Poel were out of the race. And so much so, Pidcock and probably others in that group started to panic. With 79 kilometres ago, Pidcock tried to attack on the Stokke when he was just over a minute behind the Pogacar group. Antonio Tiberi went with him and Van Sevenet as well. It wasn't really the attack that got them back on terms. There was a bit of a slowing in the Pogacar group, and there was some help from some team cars as well, wasn't there? There was a phase of the race there when it looked as though there was a barrage and the team cars weren't going to be allowed between the Pogacar group and the Pidcock group. And then we did see a Bahrain Victorious team car in particular providing some assistance, shall we say. All legal, I think. We haven't got the commissaire's report yet, but I don't think anyone's been pulled up for any drafting. And the group, including the Van der Poel group, well, they got back to Pogacar and the peloton, and it was Gruppo Compatto, sort of everyone, back together with 70 kilometres to go. I should also say the brake had been caught at this point. And then nothing really happened until, with 35 kilometres to go, the peloton swooped towards the bottom of La Redoute. EF led the peloton into the bottom of that key climb. Trek were well placed for Skelmoser and Pogacar. Well, he was sort of poised on Ben Healy's wheel. We'd seen fantastic work by Domen Novak, the UAE Team Emirates Domestique for Pogacar. He'd pulled for about 40 or 50 kilometres before La Redoute. And Novak went to the front. And Richard, with 893 metres to go to the summit of La Redoute, exactly, Pogacar reached into his back pocket and pulled out his blowtorch. And he pogcinerated everyone. Pogcinerated everyone. Richard Carapaz stayed on terms for about 300 metres, with 500 metres to go to the top of La Redoute. Carapaz's resistance, well, came to an end, shall we say, and Pogacar romped away on his own. The gap at the top of La Redoute was about 15 seconds. Pretty soon it had grown to 50 seconds with 30 kilometres to go. A four-man group formed behind Ben Healy, Bardet, Cosnefroy and Grégoire. They came into the bottom of La Rochefoucauld together. Bardet then attacked. And there was another sort of regrouping behind. We saw Egan Bernal attack as well, come back towards Bardet. Was not able to reach Bardet. So you had two men on their own at the front of the race. Pogacar, who at this point had over a minute and a half advantage, and Bardet. And that was pretty much how things remained. In the group that contested third place, or that was sprinting for third place, Mathieu van der Poel, he resurfaced and, well, he took the honours. He took third place on the podium. So, Richard, we had, if we look at the results, Tadej Pogacar winning his second Liège-Bastogne-Liège, of course. Bardet, 1 minute 39 behind. It would have been more had Pogacar not, I suppose, conceded. How many seconds did he concede? 20 seconds? Because he was celebrating. Probably similar to Strade Bianche in that respect. Van der Poel was 2 minutes and 2 seconds down, leading in that group. It was a big group in the end of 25 riders. Van Hills 4th, Aurélien Paris-Peintre 5th, Marie Van Seven 6th, Valentin Madouas 7th, Lutsenko 8th, Pale Bilbao 9th, Tom Pidcock 10th. Richard, at this stage, at this early stage in the arrivée, would you like to pick out anything else from the results there?
No, I think two key moments which you've mentioned, Daniel, but, well, I think one of them you could see was going to be influential, which was when there was that crash with 97k to go, because Van der Poel caught behind it. I think Pidcock actually, to sort of nudge you towards corrections corner slightly. I think Pidcock made it through, but he then suffered a mechanical and had to drop back.
I think the net
result was he was caught in the same group of chasers.
I think at one stage he was behind the Van der Poel group.
Was he?
That was, there was a bit of confusion with the graphic on the screen. I wondered the same thing. There was certainly a moment where I thought he was between the two groups. And after that, I sort of came to the conclusion that wasn't the case. He'd been in the Van der Poel group and then suffered a mechanical and been behind them. But I'm not entirely sure.
Mm. Well, we can both nudge ourselves over to corrections corner in advance. But regardless, the fact that those two found themselves in the back of that, in that chasing group, you know, you kind of only really have that one big bullet, don't you? And it really felt like Pidcock especially used his up on the Côte de Stocker, the Eddie Merckx monument climb. I always like that, because that's where they've got the stele Eddie Merckx, haven't they, the statue. Yes. Where it starts listing his victories, and then we run out of space and they just put et cetera on the rest, which has always stuck in my mind. I mean, actually, Van der Poel kind of came back pretty well off the back of that, all things considered. The other key point, obviously, La Redoute, where Pogacar went, what was it, 800? Remind me again, 890?
It was 893 metres.
The trundle wheel was out.
From the top of La Redoute. And I think you find Carapaz was dropped 505 metres ago from the top of La Redoute, Richard.
Very, very precise. There's a quote, actually, which Matthias Skjelmose gave Danish TV, handily translated by our colleague Brian on Twitter. He said, "It cost me my entire race trying to follow Pogacar on La Redoute. If you come too close to the sun, you get burned." And I think we saw that in the riders that did crest La Redoute at the front there. You know, they'd gone so deep into the red that they weren't really up there when it came to sort of settling those positions.
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem. We'll speak about this more. There'll be more sort of odes to Pogacar, or hymns to Pogacar, in a minute, I would suggest. But of course, Pogacar, not only does he go away, but it's also costing him less energy than it is the other riders to get that gap, which means that on the top of La Redoute, on the sort of false flat towards the top, then he can start to pull away even more. And that's exactly what we saw. He sort of crested with 15 seconds, and then 3 or 4 kilometers later, the gap was 50 seconds. You know, it's a this is something that's sort of enshrined in cycling law, that you don't attack on the climb itself or on the hardest part of the climb, but you attack on the false flat at the top. And that's, I mean, there's a strategic reason to do that, but there's also was a physiological reason to do that, that the guy who has attacked is usually the strongest guy, and that's where his extra strength tells.
I think as well, from what you could sort of tell on the TV, that the wind helped Pogacar there, where, you know, there's that quite sharp right-hand bend, isn't there, at the top of Laredut, and I think at that point he kind of picked up the wind almost, and that hands the advantage to the solo rider, doesn't it? You know, much more so than had there been a headwind or a crosswind there at that point.
Richard, I suggest we gather our thoughts and come back in just a moment with, well, at this stage, I mean, can we maybe invent some new superlatives for Tadej Pogacar? Because this whole spring feels as though it has been an exercise in precisely that, just coming up with new ways to describe the brilliance of Mathieu van der Poel and Tadej Pogacar in particular. I'm not sure whether we're going to succeed. It feels like at this point it needs a sonnet, or I don't know, maybe a 1980s ballad sung by Fred Wright with a karaoke machine to do justice to the brilliance of Tadej Pogacar. But we will endeavour to try anyway in a few minutes. It was Tadej Pogacar's 70th career win. Richard, he's now within 11 of the immortal mark of Edvald Boasenhagen. Edvald Boasenhagen's won 81 races in his career. Don't ask me why I looked this up earlier. But
I'd love to see the distribution curve for that. You know, how many were after, when was his kind of purple patch? 2009?
Oh, 10, yeah.
2010?
Yeah, 8, 9,
10.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Not a comparison that anyone who tuned into the cycling podcast Arrivé today expected to hear, but that's an extraordinary number, isn't it? Well done, Edvald. Round of applause for Edvald. And my colleague from Norwegian TV, Magnus Orde, will appreciate that comparison, I'm sure. Pogacar now 6 wins in 12 monument starts. There are all sorts of other statistics we could throw at you, and we possibly, probably will in the second part of this podcast.
You're listening to Arrivé by The Cycling Podcast. This episode is made possible by Bicycle, the leading global marketplace for pre-owned bikes.
Hello, Lionel here to tell you all about Bicycle, who have been sponsoring our series of Arrivé this spring. It's no exaggeration to say that without Bicycle support, we wouldn't have been able to bring you these episodes covering the biggest one-day races of the season so far. So a huge thank you from us to Bicycle. Check out the website, which is bicycle.com, or download the Bicycle app onto your phone, and you'll very quickly see why Bicycle is becoming the place to buy or sell a bike online. Now, any online purchase or sale comes with a degree of risk, but Bicycle eliminates that risk by covering the transaction from start to finish, giving both the buyer and seller confidence that the transaction will go through exactly as everybody hopes. Now, selling a bike can be tricky online. First of all, you want to be reaching potential customers, and the first big thing about Bicycle is that it's a community of cyclists who love bikes, whether they're buying or selling. And because of that, you've got a great degree of confidence in the bikes that are being listed, because Bicycle makes the process of listing a bike on the website or app very, very simple. I've been through the process and had a look at how it works. You can find the bike's make and model very easily. You can sort out which components and wheels the bike has got, and you can come up with a price which is not only fair to both buyer and seller, but is going to enhance your chances of selling the bike quickly. And the average bike listed on Bicycle sells within 14 days. So once you've got your bike online, you're going to be reaching potential customers immediately. It also offers some tips on how to add your photos to make your bike look the most attractive, and there you are, ready to sell. Now, selling a bike online is tricky because it's a big bulky item, isn't it? But Bicycle take care of all of that as well, because they'll take care of the shipping for you in Europe or North America, sending you everything you need to pack and ship your bike free of charge. choose the shipping date, and they'll arrange to pick up as well. And the whole process is insured as well. And the payment is guaranteed. The security of the money is paramount. And so until the bike arrives on the doorstep of the buyer, the whole transaction is covered until all parties are happy. Don't just take my word for it. Have a look at the reviews on Trustpilot. And for a limited time, Cycling Podcast listeners can sell their bike without any seller's fee at all. You just need the code TCP24. Once again, a huge thank you to Bicycle. And if you're looking to buy a secondhand bike, or perhaps you're looking to sell something to make room for something new, give Bicycle.com a go. Now it's back to Daniel and Richard for the remainder of the coverage of this year's Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
Well, Richard, you've had a couple of minutes now to compose your sonnet, write your sonnet. Let's have it. Let's be having you.
Shall I compare thee to a spring day in Belgium, Tade? That's enough of that. I need longer.
Yes, we'll have to wait for Alexander Roos's piece in L'Equipe tomorrow, won't we? I'm sure he's come up with a couple of bon mots or some cracking lines to do full justice to the brilliance of Tadej Pogacar. All we've got is bare, boring statistics, Richard. Just looking at Pogacar's results so far this year, really. Of the, I would say, 9 races that he has attempted to win, he's failed twice, I would say. And that was a second place and a third place. So the third place in Milan-San Remo, second place in the first stage of Catalunya. He won, Strade Bianche, and then the 4 stages in Catalunya that he tried to win, he won. And then the general classification in Catalunya that he tried to win, he won. And then Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
He's today, got 3 more weeks of it coming up, Daniel. I hope you're ready for...
We are going to be in Giro mode very quickly, and maybe we should spend a moment talking about that now, and the prospect of, the most emphatic pogcineration we've ever seen at the Giro d'Italia, beginning on the first day, where there is a route that lends itself to a pogcineration. On the second day, there's another route that lends itself to that. The prospects of him taking the pink jersey on day one and then consolidating, reinforcing his lead on day two is a real one. But I think what we can say before we cast our thoughts ahead to the Giro, Richard, is that this has been, and one would expect it to be at his age 25, this has been the best spring yet for Pogacar, and there have been some crackers already. Last year he left us, we were lost for words, weren't we? In fact, last year, I suppose, had he won Liège-Bastogne-Liège, because of course he had this perfect record at Flanders, Amstel, Flesch, he'd won all 3 of those, and he had won Paris. So actually, you could argue, and also Ruta del Sol, you could argue that last year's spring was even better. But age 25, obviously, for all the brilliance that he's shown us so far in his career, he's probably still 2 years away from what would ordinarily be the high watermark in a rider's career.
Yeah, and you don't ever really get the sense with Pogacar that it's weighing heavy on him, which is something that you do see with riders, that what puts an end to the sort of the success is the strain of having to back that up year after year, and the weight of expectation, whether that's from their home media. I immediately think of Remco Evenepoel, and I think his trajectory is still going up, but you wonder how long he can sustain being in the spotlight of the Belgian press, whereas there is that sort of lightness and like enthusiasm still, isn't there, with Pogacar? You still see it with the way he races, you still see it with just the way he kind of carries himself around races. That doesn't suggest to me that's gonna stop anytime soon.
Yeah, and you know, we've talked many times before on the podcast about what are the potential pitfalls. Is it money? Is it attention, scrutiny, pressure, stress? And he just seems to sort of bunny hop, dodge, skip around every one of them, or he has done so far. And I think particularly ominously for his competition is also the fact that there are imperfections, are easily identifiable imperfections, for example, in his team. And I think we saw that, to be honest, today. For all that Domen Novak, I mean, his performance today reminded me of another Slovenian's, Jan Tratnik, in the Olympic road race. Domen Novak was on the front. I don't know how many kilometers he pulled, but certainly 50 key kilometers. 50 kilometers at a point in the race when UAE were trying to force the pace, and he was making things single-handedly very hard. However, I would suggest that Tadej Pogacar this morning probably didn't plan to attack 893 meters from the top of Larrabee.
I would agree with that. It's not the most logical place to go from a tactical perspective, is it?
No, and we saw him looking over his shoulder, in fact, shortly before he did reach for the blowtorch, and I wonder whether at that point, much in the same way that he was, I think, looking for his teammates and not seeing them at the bottom of the Cipressa in Milan-San Remo, I wonder whether Mark Hirsch was supposed to be the guy leading him out for his nuclear attack. And I also wonder where João Almeida was at that point, and whether it was also in the UAE plan for those to be the two sort of last wagons in the train. And they weren't that. And consistently we see this with UAE. There's a lot that's good, but there's a lot that's also imperfect and that can be improved. You know, I talked about potential pitfalls, things that can go wrong for Pogacar. We should also bear in mind, and this is not something we know an awful lot about yet, we don't know the reasons behind it yet. I can tell you that we have got podcasts coming out in a week or so which might shed some light on this, but Pogacar's changed coaches this year, and you know, that can be a big risk, and it can be that something, or it could have been something, that derailed to a certain extent the start of a season, the start of his season. But his trajectory has continued to be this spring sort of inexorable, hasn't it?
I wonder whether, you know, at what point does boredom kick in, or not boredom, but sort of an ennui maybe with, and you wonder whether, I mean, this is pure speculation, but let's run with it. But, you know, if Pogacar had never won this race, if this was the one monument missing on his palmarès, would he have attacked when he did at the bottom of La Redoute? You know, there is a sort of, what's the best way of thinking about it? I'm just going to take my time to find the right word. He doesn't really race with that sort of pressure, does he? It's at least not in that race. He's won it before. He's already had such an amazing start to the year, and he's going to the Giro where he's head and shoulders above everybody else in terms of favourites. So, well, why not? Pourquoi pas? Why not have a stab? You've got no teammates, and this guy, Domen Novak, just dropped you off with 900 metres to go. Well, why not? Like,
893
metres. 7 metres make all the difference. Yeah. Why not? And I guess there's still plenty for him to win, isn't there? I think, you know, I was watching the race and thinking, well, we've come so close this spring to having that perfect matchup that we've all been waiting for. Like the fact that Wout van Aert wasn't there in the Cobble Classics to take on Mathieu van der Poel, and then we had Milan-San Remo, but like you said, maybe a few. Well, Pogacar a little bit let down by his team, perhaps, in that race. But you kind of almost wonder, it's like you spin the wheel and you get two of the best riders in the world, but you don't quite get the terrain that's suited for both of them. You know, Van der Poel very much on the back foot today. And then you feel like, well, if Pog went to Roubaix, well, that would be flipped the other way, where he's going to be really on the back foot.
I think that's a good point, and I think that San Remo does provide that. It does provide this really sort of tantalising terrain whereby they both have their chances, and really you feel on that terrain Pogacar is the underdog, and it's all of his kind of bravura set against, pitted against this explosive power that Van der Poel has, which should give him the advantage over Pogacar, particularly on the Poggio. But the problem with Milan San Remo is it's just so short, isn't it? And we sort of yearn, we would like them to have a sort of titanic kind of tussle that lasts for, you know, more than seven minutes or whatever it is. Whatever you think the, however long you think the finale of Milan San Remo really
And I don't
lasts.
Know how you do it, but I sort of sit on the fence when it comes to this debate. I don't know if you've been following the Formula One this weekend as well, but, you know, other drivers are coming out and saying that the dominance of Max Verstappen and Red Bull is, you know, they worry that it's going to make the sport boring. And we've seen that discussed with Pogacar and Van der Poel and these sort of Galacticos or the Super Six, whatever, who dominate races. And I do think there must be some better solution than what the sport is engineering at the moment to have those matchups a little bit more common. But how you do that, I'm not really sure. I can't think off the top of my head how you do that without ripping the calendar.
A mass cull of races is the most sensible, but probably least palatable solution for most of us. And most of us who sort of fetishize and wax lyrical about these old institutions run by these, you know, old families who have been in the sport for years and decades. And, you know, today, for example, in Italy, we saw a race revived, the Giro di Romagna, one day race that had been sort of dormant, we thought extinct for over a decade, and it's come back to life. And, you know, this is seen as cause for celebration, but it's kind of another thing that is, well, it's another option for, it could have been an option, for example, for one of those Galacticos you mentioned to ride and to take them away from something like Liège-Bastogne-Liège. In reality, I don't think anyone would choose the Giro di Romagna over Liège, but that is a scenario that we see very often. You know, you've got Tirreno or Paris-Nice. You've got we saw Adam Yates ride the Giro dell'Abruzzo a couple of weeks ago. When Catalunya was on? And we just see it again and again. And there are just so many options. There are so many ways for these riders to avoid each other. And good reasons in their own eyes. You know, they can justify why they would favour one race over another. Or their team could. Often it's commercial reasons. Or sometimes it can be practical reasons, but yeah, it's a little bit unsatisfactory. You know, it's a conversation that's been brought to the top of the agenda in, well, for example, golf at the moment, because you've got this split with the LIV Golf Tour and the PGA Tour, and there's a whole other subplot and subtext to do with, you know, where the money's coming from there. But again, the big grievance, as far as the spectators, the audience is concerned, is that the best players are not playing against each other. And that is a bit of an invidious and unsatisfactory situation, I think. Richard, I think we've probably talked enough about Pogacar for now. Anyway, bearing in mind what you said, that we are going to be talking a lot about him during the Giro d'Italia. Some other talking points. Van der Poel, obviously, his participation in Liège and his ambition to win Liège, that was one of the themes of the pre-race punditry, pre-race speculation. Will he go away sort of licking, in spite of that third place, which, you know, looks great on his pro cycling stats page, but does he go away sort of licking his wounds? He's possibly already given an interview in which he will have said one way or the other whether he thinks that actually Liège-Bastogne-Liège is not an option for him in the future to win. But just having watched the race, do you sense that he might go away thinking that actually this is just, well, it's maybe 1,000 meters of climbing too far?
I think you're right in that third place will look a lot better on the stats pages of history than it did on the ground today. It wasn't lucky, but he was a long way from, you know, let's say third place in Milan San Remo.
I wonder whether I mentioned the headwind on the way into Liège. I wonder how much that was a factor as well, because that was a mm-hmm. big group. For Liège, that is a big group, 25 mm-hmm. riders behind the sort of breakaway winners or first and second place.
I think with Van der Poel, Alpes in De Koenig were there, but not to the extent that they were in Flanders and Roubaix. So that was a factor. I wonder whether he'll come away and think, actually, if we can beef up Alpes in De Koenig a little bit, this is a race I can come back and win. Because let's imagine he had a couple of domestiques working for him in that chase group, and maybe it weren't Pogacar, maybe it were another rider that had gone off. Let's say, for argument's sake, that Van der Poel is not going to be that solo rider off the front on La Redoute. He's going to be chasing. Well, if he can stack his team with riders who can be there and help him chase at that point, maybe there's a way he can win it. I didn't see enough today to say that he's never going to win it. But I think if one of those climbing superstars rocks up in the form of Pogacar or maybe even a Paul, Vingegaard or Roglic, have they ever raced it, those two?
Yes, they have.
Then I'm not sure he stands a chance. But, you know.
Having said that, I don't think he's had to sacrifice that much. If we look at the Cobble Classic season that he's had, you know, there is always going to be the option for him. He's got nothing. He could go back to the Giro d'Italia. I don't envisage the Giro d'Italia and maybe the first pink jersey in the Giro d'Italia being a career-defining objective for him again. So he can always just bolt this on at the end of his classic season and just sort of suck it and see. One year he might have, there might be a strong headwind on the way into Liège, and you might get a big group coming into the finish. It's not an uphill finish anymore, it's not Ars. So you could conceivably see that sprint today, that could be for first place one year. So he could literally just, you know, just keep sort of reloading every year for the next 5 years. And who knows, one year it may
exactly. And I get the sense with Van der Poel as well that we're perhaps going to see him evolve slightly as a rider. You know, he's obviously become a bit of a fan of Spain and that sort of solo training that I think for a long time he was loath to do, because he'd much rather muck around in the mud for an hour in Belgium over the winter. And I think the knock-on effect of that is that, well, if you're training in Spain, where is it exactly he is? He's in the Costa Blanca, is it somewhere around there? You're going to get good at climbing. You're just going to get better at that sort of climbing. Maybe not the short, sharp efforts that you see in Liège, but still, your power to weight is going to go up and you're going to become a better climber. So I don't think Van der Poel is going to become less suited to this race as his career progresses.
Richard, a few words. We should applaud the performance of Romain Bardet, and I'd like a few words as well about Ineos Grenadiers and particularly Tom Pidcock's performance, which, as we've already hinted, or more than hinted, has to have been affected by whatever issues he had around that sort of 97 kilometre to go point when he was caught behind the crash, and then there was the mechanical as well.
There's Bardet's best ever result in a monument. Second. And
another good result for the French in a very good week for them.
And it did look like there was a point where the chase group of four riders had three Frenchmen in it alongside Ben Healy, just behind Pogacar. So, and it wasn't to be in the end. But yeah, I had to do a double take when Bardet made that chase group, because he didn't look like Romain Bardet from the distance that I could first see him. And I get the sense he's... maybe you can agree with me or disagree with me on this, Daniel, because I feel like I might just be bringing in my sort of armchair aerodynamics point of view again after Wednesday.
Come on, hit me with it.
He didn't look like Bardet because he was really kind of tucked in. And of all the riders that you think is going to survive for, what was it, 13K or something, kind of dangling out in front of a strong chase group on...
flapping around in the wind.
He's not the most sort of assured time trialist, is he?
Time trialist.
I mean, it's a different thing after 240 kilometres of a monument, isn't it? But nevertheless... I was quite sort of impressed by that ride, actually.
Yeah.
He came out of Tour of the Alps, didn't he? And he's obviously showing some decent form going to the Giro.
Yeah. He was good without being great in the Tour of the Alps.
But that's often what you see with Bardet, isn't it? Kind of good, consistent performances, maybe building towards something. So, yeah. I quite liked watching that race. If you just sort of closed one eye a little bit, forgot that Pogacar was up the road. That was a great race for second there with Bardet going on the Rochefoucauld and then the chase group sort of coalescing and merging and splitting behind and Bardet just sort of cracking on. And he looked like he was in tears at the finish line, quite emotional. So obviously meant a lot to him. He's out of contract at the end of the year, and I think am I right in saying he's going to sort of wait and see what he does?
Yes.
So yeah, could be his last Liège. But.
And Ineos Richard Pidcock, as I say, I'm sort of loath to. Well, I'm certainly not going to pass any sentences on his ability to win Liège-Bastogne-Liège. We saw last year that, you know, by finishing second, he clearly showed us that this is a race that he can win. Okay, 10th place looks like a sort of half a step back, but there were definitely mitigating factors today. And I think Egan Bernal showed us what he's shown us since the start of the season, that he's inching closer to the Egan Bernal that won the Tour de France in 2019, which, for the avoidance of doubt, is not good enough, is not enough to beat Tadej Pogacar in his present form, or the form that Tadej Pogacar will take into the Giro or the Tour. And it's not enough, obviously, to beat Jonas Vingegaard either. However, if he was to perform at that level in a Grand Tour, then, you know, he can start thinking about podiums again.
Mm. Yeah, and I think with Pidcock, much like what you said about Van der Poel, Pidcock can keep kind of reloading and having another shot at this. I don't think it's going to clash necessarily with his ambitions in the Cobble Classics if he returns to those in the future, nor if he decides to pursue Grand Tour or stage racing a little bit later on in his career. That is not going to preclude him from competing in Liège either. So. Indeed, a bit of goal, Richard. Daniel?
No. As listeners of the Cycling Podcast will know, my first team, my first footballing love is Arsenal. However, I'm a fickle and disgraceful football fan who kind of abandoned the team of my home city, Coventry City. But they are in the FA Cup semi-final today against Manchester United. So for the weekend, I've rediscovered my love for Coventry City, but they're losing 3-0 to Manchester United. On that note, and before we lose any more listeners, Richard, I should say that this week is going to be very busy on the Friends of the Podcast feed, the Kilometer Zero feed. I think tomorrow we're going to release two episodes, how to become a pro cyclist and how to become an ex-pro cyclist. The following week, we've got three episodes. We've talked about the Giro d'Italia. In this episode, we've got 3 Kilometer Zeros, which will sort of tease and look forward to our coverage in the Giro d'Italia, our daily coverage at the Giro d'Italia. Of course, I'll be there. Brian Nygaard will be there. We'll be podcasting every day. So 3 episodes the week after next, loosely relating to Pogacar's attempt to do the double. He would be the first riders to do that, Tour and Giro, Giro and Tour, since Marco Pantani in 1998. On our regular feed, what we intend to do this week is to put out a little medley which will contain sort of extracts from the 6 Kilometer Zeros that we will have released by the end of next week. So we released one last week, Diary of a CEO. That was an interview with John Allott, Ineos Grenadiers' new CEO. Then the 2 I mentioned, how to become a pro cyclist, how to become an ex-pro cyclist, and then the 3 relating to the Giro d'Italia. This week on the regular feed, I think we're going to produce a sort of medley of all 6 of those for people who currently aren't friends of the podcast, but who knows, might want to be friends of the podcast in the future. We have also got a week tomorrow, a week on Monday, we're going to have a Kilometer Zero live event. That's a virtual event where you can ask me questions and a special guest, which will be revealed tomorrow. You can ask us questions about the Giro d'Italia and what we're going to be doing on the Giro d'Italia, and so on and so forth. Keep your eye on our social media for details of that, particularly if you are a friend of the Cycling Podcast. So from Monday, from tomorrow, we will be giving you details of how to participate in that Kilometer Zero live event, which will take place a week on Monday, probably in the early evening. Richard, I think that is all the housekeeping I need to do, and that concludes our series of Arrivé episodes. Thank you for your contributions, and well, we won't be hearing from you for just a little while because we're locking into Giro d'Italia mode. I should also say, I should have said that there won't be a regular episode this week. We sort of powering down our jets, ready to go again for the Giro, but there probably will be that medley of the Kilometer Zero episodes coming out sometime in midweek.
Thanks, Daniel. It's been fun. I'm going to go lock myself away in the Sierra Nevada, so I'm going to hit peak four of July.
And write some sonnets, hopefully. Richard, thank you very much.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.